Chapter 4. We were drowning amidst petals and leaves on the plain of Sethangar, where dreams stirred like armies on the flatland, and to sing of the beauty of all these blossoms was to forget the blood that fed every root. On the plain of Sethangar we cried out for shelter from this fecund storm. The thrust and heave of life on the scouring winds was dry as a priest's voice in fiery torment, on the plain of Sethangar. And no wise words could be heard in the roar of the laughing flowers reaching out to the horizon as the pungent breath left us drunk and staggered on the plain of Sethangar. Must we ever die in the riches of our profligacy, succumbing to the earth cold and dark each time, only to burst free wide-eyed in innocent birth on the plain of Sethangar? Which god strides this field, scythe in hand, to sever the grandiose mime with edged judgment, taking from our souls all will in bundled sheaves on the plain of Sethangar, to feed as befits all burdensome beasts? Flowers will worship the tree's fickle blessing of light. Forests reach into the sweetness of a sky beyond touch, even as streams make pilgrimage to the sea, and the rain seeks union with all flesh and blood. Hills will hold fast over every plain, even Sethangar. And so we dream of inequity's end, as if it lay within our power, there in the plainness of our regard, so poorly blinded to beauty. Declamation, fragment. Cannabis brought? 1st century burns sleep. Groaning like a beast in its death throes, the ship seemed to clamber up onto the black rocks before the keel snapped and the hull split with a splintering cry. Cut and bloodless corpses rolled and slid from the deck, spilling into the thrashing foam where pale limbs flopped and waved in the tumult before the riptide dragged them tumbling over the broken seafloor out and down into the depths. The lone living figure, who had tied himself to the tiller, was now tangled in frayed ropes at the stern, scrabbling to reach his knife before the next huge wave exploded over the wreck. A salt-bleached hand, the skin of the palm hanging in blighted strips, tugged the broad-bladed weapon free. He slashed at the ropes binding him to the upthrust tiller as the hull thundered to the impact of another wave and white spume cascaded over him. As the last strand parted, he fell onto his side and slid to the crushed rail, the collision driving the air from his lungs as he pitched across the encrusted rock, then sagged, limp as any corpse, into the churning water. Another wave descended onto the wreck like an enormous fist, crushing the deck beneath its senseless power, then dragging the entire hull back into the deeper water, leaving a wake of splintered wood, lines, and tattered sail. Where the man had vanished, the inrushing seas swirled round the black rock, and nothing emerged from that thrashing current. In the sky overhead, dark clouds clashed, spun sickly arms into a mutual embrace, and though on this coast no trees rose from the ravaged ground, and naught but wind-stripped grasses emerged from pockets here and there among the rock and gravel and sand, from the wounded sky dried autumnal leaves skirled down like rain. Closer to the shore heaved a stretch of water mostly sheltered from the raging seas beyond the reef. Its bottom was a sweep of coral sand, agitated enough to cloud the shallows. The man rose into view, water streaming. He rolled his shoulders, spat out a mouthful thick with grit and blood, then waded onto the strand. He no longer carried his knife, but in his left hand was a sword in a scabbard. Made from two long strips of pale wood reinforced with blackened iron, the scabbard revealed that it was riven through with cracks as water drained out from a score of fissures. Leaves raining on all sides, he walked up beyond the tide line, crunched down onto a heap of broken shells, and sat, forearms on his knees, head hung down. The bizarre deluge thickened into flurries of rotting vegetation, like black sleet. The massive beast that slammed into him would have been thrice his weight if it was not starved. nor would it have attacked at all, ever shy of humans, but it had become lost in a dust storm, and was then driven from the grasslands leagues inland onto this barren, lifeless coast. Had any of the corpses from the ship reached the beach, the plains bear would have elected to scavenge its meal. Alas, its plague of misfortunes was unending. Enormous jaws snapped closed round the back of the man's head, canines tearing through scalp and gouging into skull. Yet the man was already ducking, twisting, his sodden hair and the sudden welter of blood proving slick enough to enable him to wrest free of the bear's bite. The sword was lying, still in its cracked scabbard, 2 paces away, and even as he lunged towards it, the bear's enormous weight crashed down onto him. Claws raked against his chain hauberk, rings snapping away like torn scales. He half-twisted round, hammering his right elbow into the side of the bear's head, hard enough to foul its second attempt to bite into the back of his neck. The blow sprayed blood from the beast's torn lip along the side of its jaw. The man drove his elbow again, this time into the bear's right eye. A bleat of pain and the animal lunged to the left. Continuing his twist, the man drew up both legs, then drove them heels first into its ribs. Bones snapped. Another cry of agony, frothing blood sprayed out from its mouth. Kicking himself away, the man reached his sword. His motions a blur of speed, he drew the weapon, alighted on his feet in a crouch, and slashed the sword into the side of the bear's neck. The ancient, watermarked blade slid through thick muscle, then bit into bone, and through, bursting free on the opposite side. Blood and bile gushed as the bear's severed head thumped onto the sand. The body sat down on its haunches, still spewing liquid, then toppled to one side, legs twitching. Blazing heat seethed at the back of the man's head, his ears filled with a strange buzzing sound, and the braids of his black, kinked hair dripped thick threads of bloody saliva as he staggered upright. On the sword's blade, blood boiled, turned black, then shed in flakes. Still the sky rained dead leaves. He staggered back down to the sea, fell onto his knees in the shallows, and plunged his head into the vaguely warm water. Numbness flowed out along the back of his skull. When he straightened once more, he saw the bloom of blood in the water, a smear stretching into some draw of current, an appalling amount. He could feel more streaming down his back now. He quickly tugged off the chain hauberk, then the filthy salt-rimed shirt beneath. He tore loose the shirt's left sleeve, folded it into a broad bandana, and bound it tight round his head, as much against the torn skin and flesh as he could manage by feel. The buzzing sound was fading. A dreadful ache filled the muscles of his neck and shoulders, and in his head there now pounded a drum, each beat pulsating until the bones of his skull seemed to reverberate. He attempted to spit again, but his parched throat yielded nothing, almost 3 days now without water. A juddering effect assailed his vision, as if he stood in the midst of an earthquake. Stumbling, he made his way back up the beach, collecting his sword on the way. Onto his knees once more, this time at the headless carcass, using his sword to carve into the torso, then reaching in to grasp the bear's warm heart. He tore and cut it loose, raised it in one hand and held it over his mouth, then squeezed it as if it was a sponge. From the largest of the arteries, blood gushed into his mouth. He drank deep, finally closing his lips round the artery and sucking the last drop of blood from the organ. When that was done, he bit into the muscle and began to eat it. Slowly his vision steadied, and he noticed for the first time the raining leaves, the torrent only now diminishing, as the heavy, warring clouds edged away out over the sea. Finished eating the heart, he licked his fingers. He roughly skinned the bear, and then rose once more and retrieved the scabbard, sheathing the sword. The drumbeat was fading, although pain still tormented his neck, shoulders, and back, muscles and tendons that had only begun their complaint at the savage abuse they had suffered. He washed the one-sleeved shirt, then wrung it, tenderly, since it was threadbare and liable to fall apart under too rigorous a ministration. Slipping it on, he then rinsed out the chain hauberk before rolling it up and settling it down over one shoulder. Then he set out, inland. Above the crest of the shoreline, he found before him a wasteland, rock, scrub, drifts of ash, and in the distance, ravines and outcrops of broken bedrock, a rumpling of the landscape into chaotic folds that lifted into raw, jagged hills. Far to his left, northward, a grainy, diffuse haze marred the sky above or beyond more hills. He squinted, studied that haze for 30 heartbeats. Patches of dusty blue above him now, as the storm rolled westward over the sea, its downpour of leaves trailing like claw marks in the air, staining the whitecaps beyond the reef. The wind lost some of its chill bite as the sun finally broke through, promising its own assault on mortal flesh. The man's skin was dark, for he had been born on a savanna. His was a warrior's build, the muscles lean and sharply defined on his frame. His height was average, though something in his posture made him seem taller. His even features were ravaged by depredation, but already the rich meat of the bear's heart had begun to fill that expression with stolid, indomitable strength. Still, the wounds blazed with ferocious heat, and he knew then that fever was not far off. He could see nothing nearby in which to take shelter, to hole up out of the sun. Among the ravines, perhaps, the chance of caves, overhangs. Yet 1,500 paces away, if not more. Could he make it that far? He would have to. Dying was unthinkable, and that was no exaggeration. When a man has forsaken Hood, the final gate is closed. Oblivion, or the torment of a journey without end, there was no telling what fate awaited such a man. In any case, Traveller was in no hurry to discover an answer. No, he would invite Hood to find it himself. It was the least he could do. Slinging the scabbard's rope belt over his left shoulder, checking that the sword named Vengeance was snug within it, its plain grip within easy reach, he set out across the barren plain. In his wake, stripped branches spun and twisted down from the heaving clouds, plunging into the waves as if torn from the moon itself. The clearing bore the unmistakable furrows of ploughs beneath the waist-high marsh grasses, each ribbon catching at their feet as they pushed through the thick stalks. The wreckage of a grain shed rose from brush at the far end. Its roof collapsed with a sapling rising from the floor as exuberant as any conqueror. Yet such signs were, thus far, all that remained of whatever tribe had once dwelt in this forest. Fragments of deliberate will gouged into the wilderness, but the will had failed. In another 100 years, Nimander knew, all evidence would be entirely erased. Was the ephemeral visage of civilization reason for fear, or perhaps relief? That all victories were ultimately transitory in the face of patient nature might well be cause for optimism. No wound was too deep to heal, no outrage too horrendous to one day be irrelevant. Nimander wondered if he had discovered the face of the one true God. Naught else but time, this ever-changing and yet changeless tyrant against whom no creature could win. Before whom even trees, stone, and air must one day bow. There would be a last dawn, a last sunset, each kneeling in final surrender. Yes, time was indeed God, playing the same games with lowly insects as it did with mountains and the fools who would carve fastnesses into them. At peace with every scale, pleased by the rapid patter of a rat's heart and the slow sighing of devouring wind against stone, content with a star's burgeoning light and the swift death of a raindrop on a desert floor. "What has earned the smile, cousin?" He glanced over at Skintik. "Blessed with revelation, I think." "A miracle, then. I think that I too am converted." "You might want to change your mind. I do not believe my newfound God cares for worship, or answers any prayers, no matter how fervent." "What's so unique about that?" Nimander grunted. "Perhaps I deserved that." "Oh, you are too quick to jump into the path of what might wound," even when wounding was never the intention. I'm still open to tossing in with your worship of your newfound god, Nimander. Why not? Behind them, Desra snorted.
I will tell you two what to worship. Power. When it is of such magnitude as to leave you free to do as you will.
Such freedom is ever a delusion, sister, Skintik said.
It is the only freedom that is not a delusion, fool.
Grimacing, Nimander said, I don't recall Andarist being very free.
Because his brother was more powerful, Nimander. Anamander was free to leave us, was he not? Which life would you choose?
How about neither? Skintik said. Although she walked behind them, Nimander could see in his mind's eye his sister's face and the contempt in it as she no doubt sneered at Skintik. Clip walked somewhere ahead, visible only occasionally. Whenever they strode into another half-overgrown clearing, they would see him waiting at the far end, as if impatient with lagging wayward children. Behind Nimander, Skintik and Desra walked the others, Nenander electing to guard the rear as if this was some sort of raid into enemy territory. Surrounded by suspicious songbirds, nervous rodents, irritated insects, Nenander padded along with one hand resting on the pommel of his sword, a glower for every shadow. He would be like that all day, Nimander knew, storing up his disgust and anger for when they all sat by the fire at night, a fire Nenander deemed careless and dangerous and would only tolerate because Clip said nothing. Clip, with his half-smile and spinning rings, who fed Nenander morsels of approval until the young warrior was consumed by an addict's need, desperate for the next paltry feeding. Without it, he might crumble, collapse inward like a deflated bladder, or lash out, yes, at every one of his kin, at Desra, who had been his lover, at Kedavis and Aranatha, who were useless, at Skintik, who mocked to hide his cowardice, and at Nimander, who was to blame for, well, no need to go into that, was there?
Do not fret, beloved. I wait for you, forever. Be strong and know this. You are stronger than you know. Think.
And all at once another voice sounded in his mind, harder, sour with venom.
She knows nothing. She lies to you.
Fayed.
Yes, you cannot be rid of me, brother. Not when your hands still burn, still feel the heat of my throat. Not when my bulging eyes stay fixed on you like nails, yes? The iron tips slowly pushing into your own eyes, so cold, such pain, and you cannot pull loose, can never escape.
Do I deny my guilt? Do I even flinch from such truths?
That is not courage, brother. That is despair, pathetic surrender. Remember withal how he took upon himself what needed doing? He picked me up like a rag doll. Impressive strength, yes. The memory heats me, Nimander. Would you lick my lips?
And she laughed.
Withal, yes. He knew what to do because you left him no choice. Because you failed. So weak you could not murder your sister. I saw as much in your eyes. At that last moment, I saw it.
Some sound must have risen from Nimander, for Skintik turned with brows raised. What is wrong? Nimander shook his head. They walked round pale-barked trees on soft loam between splayed roots, dappled sunlight and the chattering alarm of a flying squirrel on a bony branch overhead. Leaves making voices. Yes, that was all it was, whispering leaves and his overwrought imagination. Fayed snorted.
Sometimes being bad feels good. Sometimes dark lust burns like parched wood. Sometimes, my love, you awaken desire in someone else's pain. Recall that poet, Nimander, that woman of Carcanus. Andarist was reluctant to speak of her, but I found in the old scrolls all her writings. And with the tips of your fingers, all this you can train. Ha! She knew, and they all feared her, and now they will not speak her name, a name forbidden. But I know it. Shall I?
No. And Nimander's hands clutched, as if once more crushing Fayed's throat. and he saw her eyes, yes, round and swollen, huge and ready to burst. In his mind, yes, once more he choked the life from her. And from the leaves came the whisper of dark pleasure. Suddenly cold, suddenly terrified, he heard Fayard's knowing laugh.
"You look ill," Skintik said. "Should we halt for a rest?"
Nemanda shook his head. "No, let Clip's impatience drag us ever onward, Skintik. The sooner we are done." But he could not go on, would not finish that thought.
"See ahead," Destra said. "Clip has reached the forest edge, and not a moment too soon."
There was no cause for her impatience, merely a distorted, murky reflection of Clip's own. This was how she seduced men, by giving back to them versions of themselves, promising her protean self like a precious gift to feed their narcissistic pleasures. She seemed able to steal hearts almost without effort, but Nemanda suspected that Clip's self-obsession would prove too powerful, too well armored against any incursions. He would not let her into his places of weakness. No, he would simply use her, as she had so often used men, and from this would be born a most deadly venom. Nemanda had no thought to warn Clip, leave them their games and all the wounds to come.
"Yes, leave them to it, brother. We have our own, after all."
"Must I choke you silent once more, Fayard?"
"If it pleases you."
The clearing ahead stretched out, rolling downward towards a distant river or stream. The fields on the opposite bank had been planted with rows of some strange, purplish, broad-leafed crop. Scarecrows hung from crosses in such profusion that it seemed they stood like a cohort of soldiers in ranks. Motionless, rag-bound figures in each row, only a few paces apart. The effect was chilling. Clip's eyes thinned as he studied the distant field and its tattered sentinels. Chains snapped out, rings spun in a gleaming blur.
"There is a track, I think," Skintik said, "up and over the far side."
"What plants are those?"
Aranatha asked. No one had an answer.
"Why are there so many scarecrows?"
Again, no suggestions were forthcoming. Clip once more in the lead, they set out. The water of the stream was dark green, almost black, so sickly in appearance that none stopped for a drink, and each found stones to step on rather than simply splash across the shallow span. They ascended towards the field where clouds of insects hovered round the center stalk of each plant, swarming the pale green flowers before rising in a gust to plunge down onto the next. As they drew closer, their steps slowed. Even Clip finally halted. The scarecrows had once been living people. The rags were bound tightly, covering the entire bodies. Arms, legs, necks, faces, all swathed in rough cloth that seemed to drip black fluids, soaking the earth. As the wrapped heads were forward slung, threads of the thick dark substance stretched down from the gauze covering the victims' noses.
"Feeding the plants, I think," Skintik said quietly.
"Blood?" Nemanda asked.
"Doesn't look like blood, although there may be blood in it."
"Then they're still alive." Yet that seemed unlikely. None of the forms moved. None lifted a bound head at the sound of their voices. The air itself stank of death.
"They are not still alive,"
Clip said. He had stopped spinning the chain. "Then what leaks from them?" Clip moved on to the narrow track running up through the field. Nemanda forced himself to follow and heard the others fall in behind him. Once they were in the field, surrounded by the corpses and the man-high plants, the pungent air was suddenly thick with the tiny, wrinkle-winged insects, slithering wet and cool against their faces. They hurried forward, gagging, coughing. The furrows were sodden underfoot, black mud clinging to their moccasins, a growing weight that made them stumble and slip as they scrambled upslope. Reaching the ridge at last, out from the rows, down into a ditch and then onto a road. Beyond it, more fields to either side of a track, and rising from them like an army, more corpses. A thousand hung heads, a ceaseless flow of black tears.
"Mother bless us,"
Kedavis whispered.
Who could do such a thing?
All possible cruelties are inevitable, Nemanda said. Every conceivable crime has been committed. Quoting Andarist yet again.
Try thinking your own thoughts on occasion,
Desra said dryly. He saw truly. Andarist surrendered his soul and thought it earned him wisdom. Clip cut in, punctuating his statement with a snap of rings. In this case, though, he probably struck true. Even so, this has the flavor of necessity. Skintik snorted. Necessity. Now there's a word to feed every outrage on decency. Beyond the ghastly army and the ghoulish purple-leaved plants squatted a town, quaint and idyllic against a backdrop of low forested hills. Smoke rose above thatched roofs. A few figures were visible on the high street.
I think we should avoid meeting anyone, Nemanda said. I do not relish the notion of ending up staked above a plant.
That will not occur, said Clip. We need supplies, and we can pay for them. In any case, we have already been seen. Come, with luck, there will be a hostel or inn. A man in a burgundy robe was approaching, up the track that met the raised road. Below the tattered hem of the robe, his legs were bare and pale, but his feet were stained black. Long grey hair floated out from his head, unkempt and tangled. His hands were almost comically oversized, and these too were dyed black. The face was lined, the pale blue eyes wide as they took in the Tist Andi on the road. Hands waving, he began shouting in a language Nemanda had never heard before. After a moment, he clearly cursed, then said in broken Andi,
Traders of Black Coral, ever welcome! Morsco town, happy of guests and kin of Son of Darkness, come!
Clip gestured for his troop to follow. The robed man, still smiling like a crazed fool, whirled and hurried back down the track. Townsfolk were gathering on the high street, watching in silence as they drew nearer. The score or so parted when they reached the edge of the town. Nemanda saw in their faces a bleak lifelessness, in their eyes the wastelands of scorched souls, so exposed, so unguarded, that he had to look away. Hands and feet were stained, and on more than a few the blackness rimmed their gaping mouths, making the hole in their faces too large, too seemingly empty and far too depthless. The robed man was talking.
A new age, traders! Wealth, bastion, heath, even outlook rises from ash and bones. Seaman Kelik, glory of the dying god, many the sacrifices, of the willing, oh yes, the willing, and such thirst.
They came to a broad square with a bricked well on a center platform of water-worn limestone slabs. On all sides stood racks from which harvested plants hung drying upside down, their skull-sized root balls lined like rows of children's heads, faces deformed by the sun. Old women were at the well, drawing water in a chain that wended between racks to a low, squat temple, empty buckets returning. The robed man pointed at the temple, probably the only stone building in the town, and said,
Once sanctified in name of Panion, no more. The dying god now, whose body, yes, lies in Bastion. I have looked upon it, into its eyes. Will you taste the dying god's tears, my friends? Such demand!
What horrid nightmare rules here?
Skintik asked in a whisper. Nemanda shook his head.
Tell me, do we look like traitors?
How should I know?
Black Coral, Nemanda, Son of Darkness, our kinfolk have become merchants.
Yes, but merchants of what? The robed man, a priest of some sort, now led them to an inn to the left of the temple that looked half dilapidated.
Few traders this far east, you see, but roof is sound. I will send for maids. Cook, there is tavern. Opens of midnight.
The ground floor of the inn was layered in dust, the planks underfoot creaking and strewn with pellets of mouse droppings. The priest stood beside the front door, large hands entwined, head bobbing as he held his smile. Clip faced the man.
"This will do," he said. "No need for maids, but find a cook."
"Yes, a cook. Come midnight to tavern."
"Very well," the priest left. Nenanda began pacing, kicking detritus away from his path.
"I do not like this, Herald. There aren't enough people for this town. You must have seen that."
"Enough," muttered Skintik as he set his pack down on a dusty tabletop, "for planting and harvesting."
"Same Ankelic," said Nemanda. "Is that the name of this dying god?"
"I would like to see it," Clip said, chains spinning once more as he looked out through the smeared, lead-paned window. "This dying god. Is this place called Bastion on the way to Black Coral?"
Clip glanced across at Nemanda, disdain heavy in his eyes.
"I said I wish to see this dying god. That is enough."
"I thought,"
began Nenanda, but Clip turned on him sharply.
"That is your mistake, warrior. Thinking. There is time. There is always time."
Nemanda glanced across at Skintik. His cousin shrugged. Then, eyes narrowing, he suddenly smiled.
"Your god, Nemanda?"
"Yes."
"Not likely to die any time soon, then."
"No, never that."
"What are you two talking about?"
Clip demanded. Then, dismissing any possible reply, he faced the window once more.
"A dying god needs to die sometime."
"Notions of mercy, great one?" Skintik asked.
"Not where you are concerned."
"Just as well, since I could never suffer the gratitude."
Nemanda watched as Desra glided up to stand beside Clip. They stood looking out through the pane, like husband and wife, like allies against the world. Her left arm almost touching him, up near her elbow, but she would not draw any closer. The spinning rings prevented that, whirling a metal barrier.
"Tonight," Clip said loudly, "no one drinks."
Nemanda thought back to those black-stained mouths and the ravaged eyes above them, and he shivered. Mist drifted down from the park-like forest north of the Great Barrow, merging with the smoke of cook fires from the pilgrims encamped like an army around the enormous circular mound. Dawn was paling the sky, seeming to push against the unnatural darkness to the south, but this was a war the sun could not win. From the city gate, the cobbled road ran between lesser barrows where hundreds of corpses had been interred following the conquest. Malazans, Grey Swords, Rivi, Tist Andi, and Kachain Jamal. Farther to the west rose longer barrows, final home to the fallen citizens and soldiers of the city. Siodamin walked the road through the gloom, a path through ghosts, too many to even comprehend, but he thought he could hear the echoes of their death cries, their voices of pain, their desperate pleas for mothers and loved ones. Once he was past this place, who was there to hear those echoes? No one, and it was this truth that struck him the hardest. They would entwine with naught but themselves, falling unheeded to the dew-flattened grass. He emerged into morning light, like passing through a curtain, suddenly brushed with warmth, and made his way up the slope towards the sprawled encampment. For this he wore his old uniform, a kind of penance, a kind of self-flagellation. There was need, in his mind, to bear his guilt openly, brazenly, to leave himself undefended and indefensible. This was how he saw his daily pilgrimage to the Great Barrow, although he well knew that some things could never be purged, and that redemption was a dream of the deluded. Eyes fixed on him from the camps to either side as he continued on towards that massive heap of treasure, wealth of such measure that it could only belong to a dead man, who could not cast covetous eyes upon his hoard, who would not feel its immense weight night and day, who would not suffer beneath its terrible curse. He was tracked, then, by no doubt hardening eyes, the fixation of hatred, contempt, perhaps even the desire of murder. No matter, he understood such sentiments, the purity of such desires. Armor clanking, chain rustling across the fronts of his thighs as he drew ever closer. The greater vastness of wealth now lay buried beneath more mundane trinkets, yet it was these meagre offerings that seemed most potent in their significance to Siodamin.
Their comparative value was so much greater, after all. Sacrifice must be weighed by the pain of what is surrendered, and this alone was the true measure of a virtue's worth. He saw now the glitter of sunlight in the dew clinging to copper coins, the slick glimmer on sea-polished stones in an array of muted colours and patterns, the fragments of glazed ceramics from some past golden age of high culture, feathers now bedraggled, knotted strips of leather from which dangled fetishes, gored rattles to bless newborn babes and sick children. And now, here and there, the picked clean skulls of the recent dead. A subcult, he had learned, centered on the T'lani Mas, who knelt before the Redeemer and so made themselves his immortal servants. Cyrodiil knew that the truth was more profound than that, more breathtaking, and that servitude was not a vow T'lani Mas could make, not to anyone but the woman known as Silver Fox. No, they had knelt in gratitude. That notion could still leave him chilled, wonder awakened in his heart like a gust of surprised breath. Still, these staring skulls seemed almost profane. He stepped into the slightly rutted avenue and drew closer. Other pilgrims were placing their offerings ahead, then turning about and making their way back, edging round him with furtive glances. Cyrodiil heard more in his wake, a susurration of whispered prayers and low chanting that seemed like a gentle wave carrying him forward. Reaching the barrow's ragged, cluttered edge, he moved to one side, off the main approach, then settled down into a kneeling position before the shrine, lowering his head and closing his eyes. He heard someone move up alongside him, heard the soft breathing but nothing else. Cyrodiil prayed in silence. The same prayer every day, every time, always the same.
Redeemer, I do not seek your blessing. Redemption will never be mine, nor should it, not by your touch, nor that of anyone else. Redeemer, I bring no gift to set upon your barrow. I bring to you naught but myself. Worshippers and pilgrims will hear nothing of your loneliness. They armor you against all that is human, for that is how they make you into a god. But you were once a mortal soul, and so I come, my only gift, my company. It is paltry, I know, but it is all I have and all I would offer. Redeemer, bless these pilgrims around me. Bless them with peace in their need.
He opened his eyes, then slowly climbed to his feet. Beside him spoke a woman.
Benighted.
He started, but did not face her.
I have no such title, he said.
There was faint amusement in her reply.
Cyrodiil, then. We speak of you often, at night, from fire to fire.
I do not flee your venom, and should it one day take my life, so it will be.
All humor vanished from her voice as she seemed to draw a gasp, then said,
We speak of you, yes, but not with venom. Redeemer, bless us, not that.
Bemused, he finally glanced her way, was surprised to see a young, unlined face. The voice had seemed older, deep of timber, almost husky, framed in glistening black hair, chopped short and angled downward to her shoulders. Her large eyes were of darkest brown, the outer corners creased in lines that did not belong to one of her few years. She wore a woolen robe of russet in which green strands threaded down, but the robe hung open, unbelted, revealing a pale green linen blouse cut short enough to expose a faintly bulging belly. From her undersized breasts, he judged that she was not with child, simply not yet past the rounded softness of adolescence. She met his eyes in a shy manner that once again startled him.
We call you the Benighted out of respect, and all who arrive are told of you, and by this means we ensure that there is no theft, no rape, no crime at all. The Redeemer has chosen you to guard his children.
That is untrue,
perhaps.
I had heard that no harm befell the pilgrims this close to the great barrow.
Now you know why.
Cyrodiil was dumbfounded.
He could think of nothing to say to such a notion. It was madness. It was, yes, unfair.
"Is it not the Redeemer who shows us," said the woman, "that burdens are the lot of us all? That we must embrace such demands upon our souls, yet stand fearless, open, and welcoming?"
"I do not know what the Redeemer shows to anyone." His tone was harsher than he'd intended. "I have enough burdens of my own. I will not accept yours. I will not be responsible for your safety or that of any other pilgrim. This is not why I am here." Yet much as he wanted to shout that out loud, instead he turned away, marched back to the avenue. Pilgrims flinched from his path, deepening his anger. Through the camp, eyes set on the darkness ahead, wanting to be once more within its chill embrace, and the city too. The damp grey walls, the gritty cobbles of the streets, the musty cave of a tavern with its surround of pale, miserable faces. Yes, back to his own world, where nothing was asked of him, nothing demanded, not a single expectation beyond that of sitting at a table with the game arrayed before him, the twist and dance of a pointless contest. On to the road, into the swirl of lost voices from countless useless ghosts, his boots ringing on the stones. Damned fools! Down at the causeway spanning the citadel's moat, blood leaked out from bodies sprawled along its length, and in the north sky something terrible was happening. Lurid slashes like a rainbow gone mad, spreading in waves that devoured darkness. Was it pain that strangled the very air? Was it something else burgeoning to life, shattering the universe itself? Endest Silan, a simple acolyte in the Temple of Mother Dark, wove drunkenly round the bodies towards the outer gate, skidding on pools of gore. Through the gate's peaked arch he could see the city, the roofs like the gears of countless mechanisms, gears that could lock with the sky itself, with all creation. Such was Carcanus, firstborn of all cities. But the sky had changed. The perfect machine of existence was broken.
"See the sky!"
The city trembled, the roofs now ragged-edged. A wind had begun to howl, the voice of the multi-hued light storm as it lashed out, flared with thunderous fire.
"Forsaken! We are forsaken!"
He reached the gate, fell against one pillar and clawed at the tears streaming from his eyes. The High Priestess, cruel poet, was shrieking in the nave of the temple, shrieking like a woman being raped. Others, women all, were writhing on the marble floor, convulsing in unison, a prostrate dance of macabre sensuality. The priests and male acolytes had sought to still the thrashing limbs, to ease the ravaged cries erupting from tortured throats with empty assurances, but then, one by one, they began to recoil as the tiles grew slick beneath the women, the so-called nectar of ecstasy. And no man could now pretend otherwise, could not but see this the way it was, the truth of it. They fled, crazed with horror, yes, but driven away by something else. And was it not envy? Civil war had ignited, deadly as that storm in the sky. Families were being torn asunder, from the citadel itself down to the meanest homes of the commonry. Andy blood painted Carcanus, and there was nowhere to run. Through the gate, and then, even as despair choked all life from Endest Silan, he saw him approaching. From the city below, his forearms sheathed in black glistening scales, his bared chest made a thing of natural armor. The blood of Tiam ran riot through him, fired to life by the conflation of chaotic sorcery, and his eyes glowed with ferocious will. Endest fell to his knees in Anamanda's path.
"Lord, the world falls!"
"Rise, priest," he replied. "The world does not fall. It but changes. I need you. Come." And so he walked past, and Endest found himself on his feet as Lord Anamanda's will closed about his heart like an iron gauntlet, pulling him round and into the great warrior's wake. He wiped at his eyes.
"Lord, where are we going?"
"The temple.
We cannot. They have gone mad. The women, they are...
I know what assails them, priest.
The High Priestess
is of no interest to me. Anamanda paused, glanced back at him. Tell me your name.
Endest Silan, third level acolyte. Lord, please.
But the warrior continued on, silencing Endest with a gesture from one scaled, taloned hand.
The crime of this day, Endest Silan, rests with Mother Dark herself.
And then, at that precise moment, the young acolyte understood what the Lord intended. And yes, Anamanda would indeed need him, his very soul.
Mother, forgive me.
To open the way, to lead the Lord on to the unseen road.
And he will stand before her, yes, tall, unyielding, a son who is not afraid, not of her, not of his own anger. The storm, oh, the storm is just beginning.
Endest Silan sat alone in his room, the bare stone walls as solid and cold as those of a tomb. A small oil lamp sat on the lone table, testament to his failing eyes, to the stain of light upon his soul, a stain so old now, so deeply embedded in the scar tissue of his heart, that it felt like tough leather within him. Being old, it was his privilege to relive ancient memories, to resurrect in his flesh and his bones the recollection of youth, the time before the aches seeped into joints, before brittle truths weakened his frame to leave him bent and tottering.
Hold the way open, Endest Silan. She will rage against you. She will seek to drive me away, to close herself to me. Hold. Do not relent.
But, Lord, I have sworn my life to her.
What value is that if she will not be held to account for her deeds?
She is the creator of us all, Lord.
Yes, and she will answer for it.
Youth was a time for harsh judgment. Such fires ebbed with age. Certainty itself withered. Dreams of salvation died on the vine, and who could challenge that blighted truth? They had walked through a citadel peopled by the dead, the broken open, the spilled out. Like the violent opening of bodies, the tensions, rivalries, and feuds could no longer be contained. Chaos delivered in a raw and bloody birth, and now the child squatted amidst its mangled playthings with eyes that burned. The fool fell into line. The fool always did. The fool followed the first who called. The fool gave way, with cowardly relief, all rights to think, to choose, to find his own path. And so Endest Silan walked the crimson corridors, the stench-filled hallways, there but two strides behind Anamanda.
Will you do as I ask, Endest Silan?
Yes, Lord.
Will you hold?
I shall hold.
Will you await me the day?
Which day, Lord?
The day at the very end, Endest Silan. Will you await me on that day?
I said I would hold, Lord, and so I shall.
Hold, old friend, until then. Until then. Until the moment when you must betray me. No, no protestations, Endest. You will know the time. You will know it, and know it well.
It was what kept him alive, he suspected, this fraught waiting, so long all was encrusted, stiff and made almost shapeless by the accretion of centuries.
Tell me, Endest, what stirs in the great barrow?
Lord?
Is it Itkovian? Do we witness in truth the birth of a new god?
I do not know, Lord. I am closed to such things, as I have been since that day in the temple.
Ah, yes, I had forgotten. I apologize, old friend. Mayhap I will speak to Spinnock then. Certain quiet inquiries, perhaps.
He will serve you as always, Lord.
Yes, one of my burdens.
Lord, you bear them well.
Endest, you lie poorly.
Yes, Lord.
Spinnock it shall be, then. When you leave, please send for him. Not with haste, when he has the time.
Lord, expect him at once.
And so Anamanda sighed, because no other response was possible, was it?
And I, too, am your burden, Lord. But we best not speak of that. See me, Lord. See how I still wait.
Incandescent light was spilling from the half-open doors of the temple, rolling in waves out over the concourse like the wash of a flood, sufficient in strength to shift corpses about, milky eyes staring as the heads pitched and lolled. As they set out across the expanse, that light flowed up round their shins, startlingly cold. Endest Silan recognized the nearest dead Andi. Priests who had lingered too long, caught in the conflagration that Endest had felt but not seen as he rushed through the citadel's corridors. Among them, followers from various factions, Silchas Ruins, Andarists, and Anamanda's own. Dreth Denans, Hishtullas, Vanut Degalas. Oh, there had been waves of fighting on this concourse, these sanctified flagstones.
In birth there shall be blood. In death there shall be light.
Yes, this was the day for both birth and death, for both blood and light. They drew closer to the doors of the temple, slowed to observe the waves of light tumbling down the broad steps. Their hue had deepened, as if smeared with old blood, but the power was waning. Yet Endest Silan sensed a presence within, something contained, someone waiting.
For us?
The High Priestess? No. Of her, the acolyte sensed nothing. Anamanda took his first step onto the stone stairs, and was held there as her voice filled them.
No! Be warned, Anamanda, dear son. From Endi blood is born a new world. Understand me. You and your kin are no longer alone. No longer free to play your vicious games. There are now others.
Anamanda spoke.
Mother, did you imagine I would be surprised? Horrified? It could never be enough to be naught but a mother, to create with hands closed upon no one, to yield so much of yourself only to find us your only reward, us slayers, us betrayers.
There is new blood within you.
Yes.
My son, what have you done?
Like you, mother, I have chosen to embrace change. Yes, there are others now. I sense them. There will be wars between us, and so I shall unite the Andi. Resistance is ending. Andarist, Dreth Denan, Vanut Degala. Silchas is fleeing, and so too Hishtulla and Manal. Civil strife is now over, mother.
You have killed Tiam. My son, do you realize what you have begun? Silchas flees, yes, and where do you think he goes? And the newborn, the others, what scent will draw them now? What taste of chaotic power? Anamanda, in murder you seek peace, and now the blood flows, and there shall be no peace, not ever again. I forsake you, Anamanda, blood of Tiam. I deny my first children all. You shall wander the realms bereft of purpose. Your deeds shall avail you nothing. Your lives shall spawn death unending. The dark, my heart, is closed to you all.
And as Anamanda stood unmoving, Endest Silan cried out behind him, falling to his knees in bruising collapse. A hand of power reached into him, tore something loose, then was gone. Something, yes, that he would one day call by its name. Hope. He sat staring at the flickering flame of the lamp, wondering what it was that loyalty should so simply take the place of despair, as if to set such despair upon another, a chosen leader, was to absolve oneself of all that might cause pain. Loyalty, aye, the exchange that was surrender in both directions, from one all will, from the other all freedom. From one all will, from the other... The sword, an arm's length of copper-hued iron, had been forged in darkness, in Karkanas itself. Sole heirloom of House Durav, the weapon had known three wielders since the day of quenching at the Hust Forge. But of those kin who held the weapon before Spinnok Durav, nothing remained. No ill-fitting, worn ridges in the horn grip, no added twists of wire at the neck of the pommel, adjusting weight or balance. No quirk of honing on the edges. The sword seemed to have been made by a master weaponsmith specifically for Spinnok, for his every habit, his every peculiarity of style and preference. So in his kin, therefore, he saw versions of himself, and like the weapon, he was but one in a continuum, unchanging even as he knew that he would be the last. And that one day, perhaps not far off, some stranger would bend down and tug the sword from senseless fingers, would lift it for a closer examination. The water-etched blade, the almost crimson edges with the back edge sharply angled and the down edge more tapering, would squint then and see the faint glyphs nesting in the ferrule along the entire blade's length, and might wonder at the foreign marks, or not. The weapon would be kept as a trophy, as booty to sell in some smoky market, or it would rest once more in a scabbard at the hip or slung from a baldric, resuming its purpose, which was to take life, to spill blood, to tear the breath from mortal souls. And generations of wielders might curse the ill-fitting horn grip, the strange ridges of wear, and the once perfect honing that no local smith could match. Inconceivable. For Spinnok was the image of the sword lying lost, woven out of sight by grasses, the iron's sheath of oil fading and dull with dust, and then the rust blotting the blade like open sores, until, like the nearby mouldering, rotting bones of its last wielder, the sword sank into the ground, crumbling, decaying into a black, encrusted and shapeless mass. Seated on his bed with the weapon across his thighs, Spinnok Durav rubbed the last of the oil into the iron, watched the glyphs glisten as if alive, as ancient minor sorcery awakened, armoring the blade against corrosion, old magic slowly losing its efficacy. "Just like me." Smiling, he rose and slid the sword into the scabbard, then hung the leather baldric on a hook by the door.
"Clothes do you no justice, Spin."
He turned, eyed the sleek woman sprawled atop the blanket, her arms out to the sides, her legs still spread wide.
"You're back," she grunted.
"Such arrogance. My temporary absence had nothing to do with you, as you well know."
"Nothing?"
"Well, little, then. You know I walk in darkness, and when it takes me, I travel far indeed."
He eyed her for a half dozen heartbeats.
"More often of late," he said.
"Yes."
The High Priestess sat up, wincing at some pain in her lower back and rubbing at the spot.
"Do you remember, Spin, how all of this was so easy once? Our young bodies seemed made for just that one thing, beauty woven round a knot of need. How we displayed our readiness, how we preened like the flowers of carnivorous plants, how it made each of us to ourselves the most important thing in the world. Such was the seduction of that knot of need, seducing first ourselves and then others. So many others."
"Speak for yourself,"
Spinnok said, laughing, even as her words prodded something deep inside him. A hint of pain there was no point paying attention to, or so he told himself, still holding his easy smile as he drew closer to the bed.
"Those journeys into Khorald Galain were denied you for so long, until the rituals of opening seemed devoid of purpose, beyond the raw pleasure of sex.
She studied him for a moment from beneath heavy lids.
Yes.
Has she forgiven us, then? Her laugh was bitter.
You ask it so plain, as if inquiring after a miffed relative. How can you do such things, Spin? It should have taken you half the night to broach that question.
Perhaps age has made me impatient.
After the torture you just put me through, you have the patience of Lycan.
But rather more interesting, I hope.
She moved to the edge of the bed, set her bare feet on the floor, and hissed at the stone's chill.
Where are my clothes?
They burned to ash in the heat of your desire.
There, bring them over, if you please.
Now who is impatient? But he collected up her priestly robes.
The visions are growing more fraught.
Nodding, he held out her robe. She rose, turned round and slipped her arms into the sleeves, then settled back into his embrace.
Thank you, Spinach Durav, for acceding to my need.
The ritual cannot be denied, he replied, stroking her cut short midnight black hair. Besides, did you think I would refuse such a request from you?
I grow tired of the priests. Their ennui is such that most of them must imbibe foul herbs to awaken them to life. More often, of late, we have them simply service us while they lie there, limp as rotting bananas.
He laughed, stepping away to find his own clothes.
Bananas, yes, a most wondrous fruit to reward us in this strange world. That and Kellic. In any case, the image you describe is unfairly unappetizing.
I agree. And so, thank you again, Spinach Durav.
No more gratitude, please, unless you would have me voice my own and so overwhelm you with the pathos of my plight.
To that she but smiled.
Stay naked, Spin, until I leave.
Another part of the ritual? He asked.
Would I have so humbly asked if it was?
When she was gone, Spinach Durav drew on his clothing once more, thinking back to his own ritual, servicing his sword with a lover's touch, as if to remind the weapon that the woman he had just made love to was but a diversion, a temporary distraction, and that there was place for but one love in his heart, as befitted a warrior. True, an absurd ritual, a conceit that was indeed pathetic, but with so little to hold on to, well, Tist Andi clung tight and fierce to anything with meaning, no matter how dubious or ultimately nonsensical. Dressed once more, he set out. The game awaited him. The haunted gaze of Seodomin, there across from him, with artfully carved but essentially inert lumps of wood, antler and bone on the table between them. Ghostly, irrelevant players to each side. And when it was done, when victory and defeat had been played out, they would sit for a time, drinking from the pitcher, and Seodomin might again speak of something without quite saying what it was, might slide round what bothered him with every word, with every ambiguous comment and observation. And all Spinach would glean was that it had something to do with the great barrow north of Black Coral. With his recent refusal to journey out there, ending his own pilgrimage, leaving Spinach to wonder at the man's crisis of faith, to dread the arrival of true despair, when all that Spinach needed from his friend might wither, even die. And where then would he find hope? He walked the gloomy streets, closing in on the tavern, and wondered if there was something he could do for Seodomin. The thought slowed his steps and made him alter his course. Down an alley, out onto another street, this one the side of a modest hill, with the buildings stepping down level by level on each side, a cascade of once brightly painted doors, but who bothered with such things now in this eternal night? He came to one door on his left, its flaked surface gouged with a rough sigil, the outline of the great barrow in profile, beneath it the ragged imprint of an open hand. Where worship was born, priests and priestesses appeared with the spontaneity of mould on bread. Spinach pounded on the door. After a moment it opened a crack and he looked down to see a single eye peering up at him.
"I would speak to her," he said,
The door creaked back. A young girl in a threadbare tunic stood in the narrow hallway, now curtsying repeatedly.
Lord, she stammered. She's up the stairs. It is late.
Is it? And I am not a lord. Is she awake? A hesitant nod. I will not take much of her time. Tell her it is the Tist Andi warrior she once met in the ruins. She was collecting wood. I was doing very little. Go, I will wait. Up the stairs the girl raced, two steps at a time, the dirty soles of her feet flashing with each upward leap. He heard a door open, close, then open again, and the girl reappeared at the top of the stairs.
Come,
she hissed. The wood creaked beneath him as he climbed to the next level. The priestess, ancient, immensely obese, had positioned herself on a once plush chair before an altar of heaped trinkets. Braziers bled orange light to either side, shedding tendrils of smoke that hung thick and acrid beneath the ceiling. The old woman's eyes reflected that muted glow, murky with cataracts. As soon as Spinnock entered the small room, the girl left, closing the door behind her.
You do not come, said the priestess, to embrace the new faith, Spinnock Durav.
I don't recall ever giving you my name, priestess.
We all know the one who alone among all the Tist Andi consorts with us lowly humans. Beyond the old one who bargains for goods in the markets, and you are not Endest Silan, who would have struggled on the stairs and bowed each one near to breaking with his weight.
Notoriety makes me uneasy.
Of course it does. What do you want with me, warrior?
I would ask you something. Is there a crisis among the faithful?
Ah, you speak of Seerdomin, who now denies us in our need.
He does? How? What need?
It is not your concern. Not that of the Tist Andi, nor the Son of Darkness.
An Omanda Rake rules Black Coral, priestess, and we Tist Andi serve him.
The great barrow lies outside, knight. The Redeemer does not kneel before the Son of Darkness.
I am worried for my friend, priestess, that is all.
You cannot help him, nor, it is now clear, can he help us.
Why do you need help?
We await the Redeemer to end that which afflicts his followers.
And how will the Redeemer achieve such a thing except through chosen mortals? She cocked her head, as if startled by his question. Then she smiled.
Ask that question of your friend, Spinnock Durav. When the game is done and your lord is victorious yet again, and you call out for beer, and the two of you, so much more alike than you might imagine, drink and take ease in each other's company.
Your knowledge dismays me.
The Redeemer is not afraid of the dark.
Spinnock started, his eyes widening. Embracing the grief of the T'lani Mas is one thing, priestess. That of the Tist Andi. No, there may be no fear in the Redeemer, but his soul had best awaken to wisdom. Priestess, make this plain in your prayers. The Tist Andi are not for the Redeemer. God or no, such an embrace will destroy him, utterly. And by mother's own breath, it would destroy us as well.
Seerdomin awaits you, she said, and wonders, since you are ever punctual.
Spinnock Durav hesitated, then nodded, hoping that this woman's god had more wisdom than she did. Hoping, too, that the power of prayer could not bend the Redeemer into ill-conceived desires to reach too far, to seek what could only destroy him, all in that fervent fever of gushing generosity so common to new believers. Priestess, your claim that the great barrow lies beyond my lord's responsibilities is in error. If the pilgrims are in need, the Son of Darkness will give answer.
And so lay claim to what is not his.
You do not know Anamanda Rake.
We need nothing from your lord.
Then perhaps I can help.
No, leave now, Tist Undie. Well, he had tried, hadn't he? Nor did he expect to gain more ground with Cerdamin. Perhaps something more extreme was required. No, Cerdamin is a private man. Let him be. Remain watchful, yes, as any friend would. And wait.
If he had walked from the nearest coast, the lone figure crossing the grasslands of North Lammertath had travelled 100 leagues of unsettled prairie. Nowhere to find food beyond hunting the sparse game, all of it notoriously fleet of foot and hoof. He was gaunt, but then he had always been gaunt. His thin grey hair was unkempt, drifting out long in his wake. His beard was matted, knotted with filth. His eyes, icy blue, were as feral as any beast of the plain. A long coat of chain rustled, swinging clear of his shins with each stride. The shadow he cast was narrow as a sword. In the cloudless sky wheeled vultures or ravens or both, so high as to be nothing but specks, yet they tracked the solitary figure far below. Or perhaps they but skirled in the blue emptiness, scanning the wastes for some dying, weakening creature. But this man was neither dying nor weak. He walked with the stiff purpose characteristic of the mad, the deranged. Madness, he would have noted, does not belong to the soul engaged with the world, with every hummock and tuft of grass, with the old beech ridges, with their cobbles of limestone pushing through the thin patched skin of lichen and brittle moss, with the mocking stab of shadow that slowly wheeled as the sun dragged itself across the sky, with the sounds of his own breath that were proof that he remained alive, that the world had yet to take him, pull him down, steal the warmth from his ancient flesh. Madness stalked only an inner torment, and Kalor, the High King, supreme emperor of a dozen terrible empires, was, in his heart, a man at peace. For the moment. But what mattered beyond just that? This single moment, pitching headlong into the next one, over and over again, as firm and true as each step he took, the hard ground reverberating up through the worn heels of his boots. The tactile affirmed reality, and nothing else mattered and never would. A man at peace, yes, indeed. And that he had once ruled the lives of hundreds of thousands, ruled over their useless, petty existences, that he had once, with a single gesture, condemned a surrendered army of 15,000 to their deaths, that he had sat a throne of gold, silver, and onyx, like a glutton stuffed to overflowing with such material wealth that it had lost all meaning, all value. Ah, well, all that remained of such times, such glory, was the man himself, his sword, his armour, and a handful of antiquated coins in his pouch. Endless betrayals, a sea of faces made blurry and vague by centuries, with naught but the avaricious, envious glitter of their eyes remaining sharp in his mind, the sweep of smoke and fire and faint screams as empires toppled one after another, the chaos of brutal knights fleeing a palace in flames, fleeing such a tide of vengeful fools that even Kalor could not kill them all, much as he wanted to, oh yes. None of these things awakened bitter ire in his soul. Here in this wasteland that no one wanted, he was a man at peace. Such truth could not be challenged, and were someone to rise up from the very earth now and stand in such challenge, why, he would cut him to pieces, smiling all the while to evince his calm repose. Too much weight was given to history as far as Kalor was concerned. One's own history, that of peoples, cultures, landscapes. What value peering at past errors in judgment, at mischance and carelessness, when the only reward after all that effort was regret? Ah, regret was the refuge of fools, and Kalor was no fool. He had lived out his every ambition, after all, lived each one out until all colour was drained away, leaving a bleached, wan knowledge that there wasn't much in life truly worth the effort to achieve it, that the rewards proved ephemeral, nay, worthless. Every emperor in every realm, through all of time itself, soon found that the lofty title and all its power was an existence devoid of humour. Even excess and indulgences palled, eventually. And the faces of the dying, the tortured, well, they were all the same, and not one of those twisted expressions vouchsafed a glimmer of revelation, the discovery of some profound last-breath secret that answered all the great questions. No, every face simply pulled into itself, shrank and recoiled, even as agony tugged and stretched, and whatever the bulging eyes saw at the last moment was, Kalor now understood, something utterly banal. Now there was an enemy, banality. The domain of the witless, the proud tower of the stupid. One did not need to be an emperor to witness it. Scan the faces of people encircling an overturned carriage, the gleam of their eyes as they strain and stretch to catch a glimpse of blood, of broken limbs, relishing some pointless tragedy that tops up their murky inkwells of life. Watch, yes, those vultures of grief, and then speak of noble humanity, so wise and so virtuous. Unseen by the ravens or condors, Kalor had now bared his teeth in a bleak smile, as if seeking to emulate the face of that tragically fallen idiot, pinned there beneath the carriage wheel, seeing the last thing he would see, and finding it in the faces of the gawkers, and thinking, "Oh, look at you all, so banal, so banal." He startled a hare from some scrub 20 paces away, and his left hand flashed out, underhand, and a knife sped in a blur, catching the hare in mid-leap, flipping it round in the air before it fell. A slight tack, and he halted to stand over the small, motionless body, looking down at the tiny droplets of spilled blood. The knife sunk to the hilt, driven right through just in front of the hips. The gut, then, not good. Sloppy. He crouched, pulled loose the knife, then quickly sliced open the belly and tugged and tore out the hare's warm intestines. He held the glistening ropes up in one hand, studied them, and whispered, "Banal!" An eye of the hare stared up sightlessly, everything behind it closed up, gone away. But he'd seen all that before, more times than he could count. Hares, people, all the same. In that last moment, yes, there was nothing to see, so what else to do but go away? He flung the guts to one side, picked up the carcass by its elongated hind limbs, and resumed his journey. The hare was coming with him, not that it cared. Later, they'd sit down for dinner. High in the sky overhead, the black specks began a descent. Their equally empty eyes had spied the entrails, spread in lumpy grey ropes on the yellow grasses, now in the lone man's wake. Empty eyes, but a different kind of emptiness. Not that of death's banality, no, but that of life's banality. The same kind of eyes as Kalor's own. And this was the mercy in the hare's swift death. For unlike countless hundreds of thousands of humans, the creature's last glimpse was not of Kalor's profoundly empty eyes, a sight that brought terror into the face of every victim. The world, someone once said, gives back what is given, in abundance. But then, as Kalor would point out, someone was always saying something, until he got fed up and had them executed.